Chapter 9. Michael's alarm blared out. It was 6 a.m. and he'd been asleep for all of 90 minutes. The continuity screen flickered across the TV as he jerked out of bed. Rushing downstairs, he pulled open the front door. It was lashing down with rain and utterly frigid. Were mornings always this cold? Snatching the key off the rack, he darted to the end of the lawn, not bothering with a rain jacket. His hands trembled as he fumbled with the latch. "Come on, come on," he muttered, forcing the key in. He wrenched the flap open, revealing an empty cavern. Sighing with relief, he slumped against the mailbox. His eyes followed the pipe into the ground, where it disappeared beneath the grass and roads, and joined an invisible network leading back to the ministry. A clicking noise pricked his ears. Across the road, a neighbor was locking her box back up. Unlike Michael, she looked bitterly disappointed. He caught her eye, but she turned away, bowing her head in shame until she disappeared inside the house. He remembered when that couple had moved in as newlyweds 10 years ago. They used to be so lively, so sociable. Yet this was the first time he'd seen her in months. Michael traipsed back inside, squelched upstairs, and put on dry pajamas. As he slumped into bed, relief washed over him, and with it, precious sleep. He awoke some hours later, cursing. Now he was running late, even later than normal. He threw on clean clothes, an intoxicating amount of deodorant, and hurried out of the house. Miraculously, the school bus was still on his street. He could make it if he ran. But he didn't want to make it. The bus would be stopping by the ministry. His grandfather's words rang in his ears.
"If you did your letter wrong, we'd know about it."
His family didn't know yet. But the ministry did. An automaton had already traced him to the restaurant, and it was only a matter of time before they tried again. Michael had to keep a low profile until he could figure out how to undo the damage. Setting off at a brisk march, Michael tucked into a side street and began the long, arduous detour around the ministry building. It took him 2 hours to reach school, through a mixture of jogging and marching. By the time he arrived, he was drenched in sweat and his stomach was rumbling. Signing himself in, he waved away the secretary's words about consequences for punctuality and slid into his history lesson.
"Mr. Hadley, you're late, and dare I say it, wet. For a man due to graduate in a matter of months, this bodes ill for your career prospects. We are unburdened?"
"Yes, ma'am. I mean, may we use it well," mumbled Michael, bowing as custom dictated.
"Indeed," continued the teacher with a raised brow. "Did we forget something else today, Mr. Hadley?"
Michael looked around the room in dismay, surveying the rows of pupils in black funeral attire. His peers were snickering at him, pointing at his regular clothes with mirth.
"It's tribute day," sighed Michael.
"I would call this a poor tribute, Mr. Hadley. What would your ancestors say if this was your way of paying respects for their sacrifice? Your classmates know the importance of their heritage, yet you see fit to beat your own path, it would seem. That must require a special kind of arrogance."
"It's not like that, ma'am. I just forgot. Obviously, I know it's a big day."
"Big? Big? It's tribute day, you ungrateful wretch. We're commemorating the darkest day in our city's history."
"I know, I know. A small group of mentally unwell individuals challenged the benevolence of our ministry. They marched on Ministry Square with burning torches and burned the Vellum Creed."
The teacher considered this nugget of information, sliding her round glasses higher up her piggish nose.
"I'm glad to see you at least did your preparatory reading," she mused. "And do you know what happened then?"
"The fire spread?" asked Michael.
He hadn't exactly finished the reading.
"It engulfed the entire ministry, the very heart of our people," exclaimed the teacher. "But that small band of renegades, while they succeeded in destroying the fabric of the building, they could not destroy the spirit of its people. As the cowards fled, believing their work to be complete, our ancestors formed dozens of human chains, ferrying water to douse the flames. It was a truly historic act of societal union."
The teacher took a beat to regain her composure, having become somewhat animated in her recitation.
"Can anyone tell Mr. Hadley what happened next?"
"Thanks to the people's unity, the building was saved," said a girl in the front.
It wasn't saved, dummy. It was burned to the ground. They rebuilt it using stone, chimed her neighbor.
Indeed, they did, said the teacher. But what of the Vellum Creed? Mr. Hadley, when you went to the ministry for your recent ceremony, did you see such a document?
No, ma'am. Just a marble font.
And could you read the inscribed creed?
Sort of. I think it's mostly been rubbed away over the years, though.
Can anyone correct poor Mr. Hadley? It would appear that history, like punctuality, is not his forte.
A boy from the middle chimed up.
The ancestors didn't write it down. Not like the old one, at least. They decided the safest place for the creed was in the hearts and minds of every citizen in the city. Our people committed it to memory, so that it can never be lost or destroyed again. The stone font is a symbol to remind us of our ancestors' fortitude.
The teacher smiled like a smug cat.
It's amazing what can be learned by those who turn up on time and do their full homework. Wouldn't you agree, Mr. Hadley? Take your seat. Now, can anyone tell me why our school celebrates Tribute Day a week before all the others? And for a bonus point, what year that tradition began?
Keeping his head down, Michael hurried to his seat. The teacher continued a Q&A with the class's keenest, while chalking up that week's homework on the board.
Don't worry, pal. I hear it's old bollocks anyway,
muttered Hamish, Michael's go-to partner in crime for talking in class and failing assignments.
You mean Tribute Day? Whispered Michael.
My brother told me it's a lie. He said there was no wooden minister building, no vellum creed. Even the fire bits made up.
But the uprising?
Well, that bit's true. But he says he was suppressed by the automatons, with people fighting alongside them. Apparently, the only thing that burned was the bodies of the dead revolutionaries piled up in the minister square.
But what happened to their...
A cane cracked down on Hamish's desk.
Principal's office. Now,
snapped the teacher. Michael and Hamish jumped, neither having seen nor heard the hawkish woman approaching. She loomed over Hamish with an eviscerating glare.
Oh, I didn't mean to cause trouble, ma'am. It's just goofing around, said Hamish.
Not another word.
The teacher's voice was low and quivering with such rage as if she might strike him at any moment. Hamish glanced at Michael nervously, then packed his bag and left the room. Michael watched his confidant leave. This was devastating. He hadn't even had a chance to tell Hamish about what really went down during his minister visit. He would have to wait. The teacher's voice fizzled into nothingness as the class resumed. Michael's mind immediately drifted back to the ministry's mailroom, reliving the moment he challenged the automaton. Was it dead? Could those things even die? He couldn't ask without arousing suspicion. Those things were basically sacred. If you broke the mutuality pact, there were consequences. He couldn't so much as breathe a word to another living soul without invoking the wrath of the entire city, human and metal alike. Lunch was over in a flash. He devoured a mini mountain, then napped against the table until the bell rang. As he and thousands of other pupils headed back to class, there was an excited buzz ahead. A teacher was calling for students to make way. Michael's heart skipped a beat. Gliding through the sea of students was an automaton, the same one from the restaurant. Its tainted face bore the same rigid smile as it rolled through the crowd. Michael thumped his friend's chest.
Cover for me, Doug.
With that, he turned and threw himself against the tide of people.
Dude, where are you going?
Michael ignored his friend and pushed harder, fighting his way back towards the canteen.
Hey, watch it,
complained a girl as he barged through her group.
Michael,
said his sister, baffled.
Sophia, your brother's a weirdo, said one of them. Oh my God, don't even, she said, rolling her eyes.
As Michael reached the canteen doorway, he cast his head back. The machine had spotted him. Sprinting across the food hall, he kicked open the emergency exit. Michael raced across the sports field towards the woods. To his horror, the machine was sprinting across the turf after him. Whimpering, Michael tore through the trees, tripping over gnarled roots and covering himself in mud as he tumbled down an earthy embankment. Scrambling back to his feet, he ran with all his might. The machine was falling behind, moving more cautiously over the uneven terrain. Michael pressed his advantage and staggered onto the road beyond. Without a moment's hesitation, he ran out in front of an oncoming pickup truck. The driver blared his horn and screeched to a halt.
Are you insane?
Cried the contractor.
I'm sorry, it's an emergency, said Michael.
He pulled open the passenger door and jumped in before the man could object.
What kind of emergency?
Said the contractor sternly.
I'm being bullied. Please, I just need to get away. They already beat me up once,
said Michael, checking the rearview mirror.
Want me to deal with them? Said the contractor.
No, I mean, no thank you. I just need to get to town. I'll figure it out from there. The contractor grunted and they set off. Michael pretended to listen to the man's lecture about standing up to bullies as they entered the business district, where a lengthy traffic jam brought them to a halt. Michael's eyes fell on the winged mirror, and his heart froze. The automaton had caught up and was weaving through the tailback. Michael fled the truck, running away from the traffic jam and making a beeline for the metro station. Leaping the turnstile, he descended the escalator two steps at a time. The platform was all but deserted as he skidded out and sped to the far end. Metal footsteps rang out from the escalator. Michael ducked behind a pillar and waited, praying the machine would pass him by as his heart pounded in his ears. The automaton's steps halted as it reached the platform, giving way to the squeaking of its wheels. The machine paused sporadically, each time letting its head click in rotation. Michael's pulse quickened as it wheeled closer. It was just yards away now. Michael's muscles quivered with adrenaline. The automaton discovered Michael's pillar and locked eyes with him. With a cry, Michael surged forward, pushing it as hard as he could. The machine toppled over the platform edge, landing on the tracks with a clang. The machine was splayed out on its back, its fingers twitching. It tried to rotate its head to look at Michael, but its neck was broken. A rumbling noise echoed from the dark metro tunnel. Michael was about to flee when something caught his eye. Clasped in the automaton's hand was a glass rectangle. Bursts of color shimmered through the glass, revealing symbols as Michael moved. They looked hauntingly familiar. Michael leaped onto the tracks. Someone entering the platform saw him and screamed. The sound of running footsteps and cries for help filled the air. The approaching train's headlights bounced off the tracks. Michael prized the glass token from the machine's hand, then hauled himself onto the platform.
It fell. I tried to help it, but it's too heavy,
cried Michael, dragging himself up. Michael raced past the alarmed onlookers and up the escalator. Screeching brakes and crunching metal drowned out the sound of his footsteps. Emerging onto street level, he staggered into a side alley to catch his breath and examine the stolen object. It was the size of a matchbox. Something was suspended in the glass itself, a vitrified wafer, less than a millimeter thick. The symbols glimmered as he tilted it in his hand. What did it mean? He peered back at the metro. To his relief, the machine was absent, as were the platform people. His gaze drifted to the curved pyramid on the horizon, its golden bricks rising above nearby office blocks. Michael slipped the glass into his pocket and set off at once. They might have the answers he needed. He approached the university warily, sticking to back streets. The pyramid was opposite the ministry building, connected by the great square. He was loath to get so close, but he needed answers fast. He hastened towards the imposing gold entrance and pushed through the rotating door. Golden light bathed the interior, filtering through the translucent bricks. A stern receptionist peered up from behind her spectacles.
Yes?
Michael pulled a stray leaf from his hair and hastily wiped his muddy hands against his even muddier jeans.
I'd like to speak to someone about an artifact, he said.
Was that the right word? He had no idea.
Are you trying to sell something illegally? We're not interested in that sort of business.
Nothing like that. I'm doing some research, a personal project.
Carolina Masorki is professor of historical artifacts. You'll have to make an appointment. She's extremely busy. It may be weeks before she can see you, though. Months, even.
Michael took a prospectus from the front desk and said he'd mull it over. Leaving the dazzling gold atrium, he crossed the street. Hidden from the ministry and obscured behind some parked cars, he set up camp on a bench overlooking the university entrance. It was a long wait, but as 5 p.m. came, so too did Professor Masorski, a spitting image of her own starchy prospectus portrait. Michael set off after her. To his horror, she was heading for the great square. He had to intercept her before they got near the ministry.
Professor Masorski, excuse me, he called, jogging over.
She looked at him warily.
Forgive my appearance. It's been a rough day. I need to ask you a question, panted Michael. Make an appointment with my secretary. I'm rather busy at present. I think I found an artifact. It's a piece of glass, only small, though. It would fit in your hand. It's got symbols embossed on the side, and they glimmer in different colors when you tilt it in the sun. The professor's face fell.
Is this a trick? I don't know how you've learned of such things, but I'm not prepared to discuss this further until I do.
No trick, I swear. Please, I just need an opinion. I can't advise on something I've never seen, she snapped. With that, she turned on her heel.
Wait!
Called Michael. He shuffled closer and drew the glass block from his pocket. The professor gasped and took it in her hands, marveling at it.
It's still intact, she said in awe.
Where did you get it?
Found it, said Michael.
You're lying, but perhaps it's better I don't know the full picture. These glass slices aren't artifacts, they're called sequela.
Consequences, in other words. They're linked to an individual's being, their health, their life, and so forth.
So much of what we are is stored in these forbidden capsules. Our lives are constantly changing, and so too are the capsules we are made of. Something must have changed upstream in this person's life, causing their sequela to be released.
I don't understand, said Michael.
It means the person's in danger.
The person?
These blocks are unique. The symbols relate to an individual citizen, and the citizen on this block is in trouble, that's for sure, she said.
As the professor crossed into the grand square, Michael snatched the glass from her hand.
Careful with that! You shouldn't even have it! Wait, where are you going? I can't let them get me, I can't!
Cried Michael.
What's your name? She cried.
With the glass clutched in his palm, he vanished into the rush hour traffic.